the world's largest economy to avoid defaulting on its debt repayments. Republican leader Kevin McCarthy told reporters in Congress, "We've got to pause. We can't be spending any more money next year." A default could ignite a firestorm in global markets, with investors nervously watching as the talks have unfolded. U.S. stock indexes, which had been trending higher, changed course later on Friday on the news. Republicans say President Biden must sign up to spending cuts in exchange for their support to raise the debt ceiling, ignoring repeated Democratic calls for a clean increase of the borrowing limit with no strings attached. Democrats have framed the talks as an opportunity to discuss the upcoming budget ahead of 1st of June, when the Treasury predicts the United States could start defaulting on its debts, with dire economic consequences. On Friday, the White House said significant problems remained between the two sides over the budget. A White House official said in a statement, "There are real differences between the parties on budget issues and talks will be difficult." The president's team is working hard towards a reasonable bipartisan solution that can pass the House and the Senate. The Punch Bowl News political website has also covered the same story. On Friday, Republicans' chief negotiators in the talks, Congressmen Garrett Graves and Patrick McHenry, abruptly left the negotiating session alongside Kevin McCarthy and have no plans to return. Patrick McHenry said, "We have a gap on many issues. The main sticking point was reportedly the rolling back of federal spending to 2022, demanded by House Republicans' right-wing Freedom Caucus, which accounts for around a fifth of the membership. In total, the cuts to federal agencies and programs demanded by Republicans in exchange for their support to lift the debt ceiling are worth around $130 billion. They also want to expedite domestic energy production projects, simplifying the process for obtaining permits for pipelines and refineries, and claw back unspent COVID relief funding. As the deadline draws closer, Democrats in both chambers of Congress have been voicing increasing disquiet over Republican demands, threatening to withdraw their support over proposals to impose tougher work requirements on recipients of certain benefits. Congressional Hispanic Caucus leader Nanette Barragan tweeted, "Republicans are threatening to tank our economy unless we slash Medicare, evict thousands from public housing, and put almost a million Americans out of work." Nanette Barragan added, "Their plan puts politics over people. We must pass a clean debt ceiling now." The International Monetary Fund, the IMF, has warned of severe consequences for the global economy if the United States defaults on its debt obligations. The International Monetary Fund raised the alarm recently ahead of a rapidly approaching deadline for U.S. lawmakers to suspend or approve the raising of the government's colossal debt ceiling. International Monetary Fund Communications Director Julie Kozak told reporters, "Our assessment is that there would be very serious repercussions not only for the United States but also for the global economy should there be a U.S. debt default." Julie Kozak encouraged U.S. Republicans and Democrats who remain sharply divided over the debt ceiling to urgently resolve this issue. Russia's Sputnik News Agency has also covered the same story and tells us more. As U.S. Democrats and Republicans continue to haggle over the nation's debt ceiling, a Morning Consult opinion poll showed recently 80% of Americans believe that a U.S. default on its debt would result in a worsened economy. 75% think that the default would lead to a substantial decline in the stock market, followed by 72% who say it would cost the country its standing As a financial leader internationally, however, Americans are less likely to think that they would be affected personally, with 39% holding this view. Voters from both political parties agree about the most likely outcome of a debt default. 79% of Democrats and 81% of Republicans and independent voters believe that the economy would tumble, while 77% of Democrats, 74% of independents, and 75% of Republicans say they expect the stock market to fall. The U.S. Congressional Budget Office, the CBO, warned recently that the country faced a significant risk of defaulting within the first 2 weeks of June if lawmakers fail to increase the amount of debt the country is legally allowed to take on. Republicans in Congress are adamant that the Biden administration agree to major budget cuts in return for their support to raise the $31.4 trillion federal debt limit before the U.S. runs out of money to pay its existing bills. Democrats are accusing Republicans of using extreme tactics to try and push their political agenda ahead of the so-called X date, which the U.S. Treasury recently warned could come as soon as 1st of June. The X date is a point at which the U.S. government will be unable to meet its financial obligations. While the U.S. is struggling with these economic issues, it is also facing the prospect of de-dollarization, which is gaining momentum since many countries are queuing up to join forces and wean their respective economies off the U.S. dollar. Meanwhile, U.S. bank failures are occurring at an unprecedented rate, worrying bank depositors and investors. Economists say it is indicative that another financial crisis is on the horizon, given the unstable state of the U.S. economy. The American newspaper The Hill has also covered the same story. According to a new opinion poll, 3 in 5 Americans now say inflation is causing them financial hardship, an increase from the end of last year. A Gallup opinion poll released recently showed 61% of respondents said recent price increases have caused severe or moderate financial hardship, 6 points higher than the level last November. That includes 15% who said the hardship is severe. Pollsters found inflation is having the most significant effect on those making less than $40,000 per year, with 29% of them saying they're experiencing severe hardship and 46% saying they're facing moderate hardship. Only 15% of those making $40,000 to $99,999 annually said they're having severe hardship, while 50% said it is moderate. 5% of those making $100,000 or more said it is severe, and 40% said it is moderate. Consumer prices rose by 0.4% last month for a 4.9% annual rate, the lowest level for inflation since April of 2021. Inflation has been consistently falling as the U.S. Federal Reserve has raised interest rates to get prices under control. But Gallup said in its analysis that the results of the opinion poll might demonstrate higher prices for the past 2 years might be taking a cumulative effect on consumers. Inflation hit a 40-year high of 9.1% annually last June, before the consistent decreases in the months since then. A second opinion poll Gallup released with the first shows 35% of Americans mentioned the high cost of living and inflation as the most important financial problem facing their family now, significantly higher than any other issue. The cost of owning or renting a home came in second place at 11%. Gallup concluded, "The increases in these readings suggest that the recent slowing of inflation has so far done little to provide relief for the American public, and it may take more dramatic changes in prices for the harmful effects of inflation to subside."
the wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Syrian President Bashar al-Assad at the Arab League summit. His one-time enemy, Saudi Arabia's Mohammed bin Salman, seen here greeting him. A symbolic moment, sealing Assad's reintegration into the Arab fold after being suspended from the League and isolated by most of the region for over a decade. A man who wanted him dethroned, who supported terrorist groups with the sole aim of toppling him. But now, that is wonder under the bridge. Assad lining up for the League's family photograph. Every handshake, confirmation of his reintegration. One after the other, Arab leaders welcoming Syria's reintegration, and during his own address, Assad repeatedly said that Syria belonged to the Arab world. There have been words of condemnation against Saudi Arabia and the Arab League normalizing ties, rhetoric from the losing end of the so-called Syrian opposition, something that should be shelved in the archives. But there is a new reality taking shape in West Asia. The Arab League Secretary General made sure to relay that message. Saudi Arabia is now a firm believer that security cannot be bought and that countries in this region can establish their own security. The Saudi Foreign Minister, Prince Faisal bin Farham, called for cooperation between Arab countries to achieve security, stability, and economic prosperity. West Asian security, however, does not serve the interests of the U.S. All of these reconciliations with Syria is shunned and rejected by the U.S. The decision to readmit Syria to the Arab League represents a rejection of U.S. interests. The Arab rush to welcome Damascus back into the fold has happened despite public objections from the U.S. U.S. efforts at easing Mr. Assad out and replacing him with an inclusive, democratic government have gone nowhere, leaving American officials on the sidelines. That is one view. However, additionally, U.S. lawmakers are proposing a bill that would prohibit Washington from either recognizing or normalizing relations with any Syrian government led by Assad. The legislation is also a warning to Turkey and Arab countries that if they engage with Assad's government, they could face severe consequences. But who's listening? Challenges do remain. Arab countries are keen to invest in Syria, especially in its reconstruction. But the U.S. legislation builds upon the CSAR Syria Civilian Protection Act, a 2019 law that authorized sanctions on those who do business with the Syrian government. Then there's the issue of Israel, who has continued bombing Syria. How will Arab countries deal with Israel when it comes to Syria? Israel is one of the sorest losers in this, since now there's a stronger united front in the form of an axis of resistance against Israel. On the one hand, the U.S., who is occupying Syrian soil and stealing and selling its oil, is an outsider, accompanied by the Israeli regime, which has no cards left to unify Arab countries against Iran. Nevertheless, China's view on the diminished U.S. role in the region, which closely mirrors Iran's stance, has said it best. Syria's Arab League reintegration, proof that when the U.S. shadow shrinks, peace spreads.
On September 9, 2001, a series of terror attacks targeted the United States. On that morning, a group of terrorists hijacked four commercial airliners. The hijackers crashed the first two planes into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York City. The third plane succeeded in crashing into the Pentagon, but the fourth one crashed in rural Pennsylvania. The U.S. regime used the incident to launch what it called the Global War on Terror.
They are obsessed with fueling conflict because they profit by the bloodshed, by the turmoil, by the tension, by the diplomatic unease. A lot of money is transferred into the bureaucracies of the military, the intelligence community, the diplomatic community, the military-industrial complex, the war profiteers who make bullets, bombs, tanks, helicopters, guns.
Washington first invaded Afghanistan and then attacked Iraq. A number of other countries were also affected by the wars.
Hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed, 7,000 by the U.S. in the first month of the war, but now hundreds of thousands of civilians were killed by all parties over the 20 years, and that's in part because Iraq descended into civil war shortly after the U.S. invasion. And then in addition, many millions of people were displaced. Millions of people are still displaced internally and also as refugees in the region.
The military aggressions were devastating for the affected countries and killed countless people. A new research by Brown University's Cost of War project has now shed light on the human cost of U.S. wars in the region. The report says America's war on terror in war zones of Afghanistan, Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, and Yemen killed at least 4.5 to 4.6 million people, though the precise mortality figure remains unknown. The study reviews a wide range of factors contributing to mortality. Those include economic collapse and the resulting loss of livelihood for local residents, the destruction of health infrastructure and public services, environmental contamination, as well as other cultural effects of war that can lead to further violence down the line. Some of these people were killed in the fighting, but far more, especially children, have been killed by the reverberating effects of war, such as spread of disease. The report says these latter indirect deaths are estimated to be around 3.7 million. It says these deaths and related health problems have resulted from the destruction of economies, public services, and the environment in the affected countries. The report has also highlighted the fact that indirect deaths grow in scale over time. The researchers found staggering levels of child malnutrition in some of the affected countries, with Afghanistan and Yemen topping the list. In the wake of Washington's two-decade military occupation, more than 3 million Afghan children are now experiencing wasting, a symptom of severe and potentially life-threatening malnutrition. The U.S. officially ended its war in Afghanistan, but today Afghans are suffering and dying from war-related causes at higher rates than ever. Afghanistan's economy has collapsed, and over half of the population now lives in extreme poverty on less than $1.90 per day. More than 7.6 million children under 5 are suffering from acute malnutrition or wasting in Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen, and Somalia. Wasting means simply not getting enough food, literally wasting to skin and bones, putting these children at greater risk of death. Diseases such as measles and cholera often sicken malnourished people, particularly children, and at the same time worsen malnutrition.
And then what we also see is that even in the places where the fighting has stopped, civilians and other people, like healthcare workers, have been injured by unexploded ordnance, which has been left in the wake of the war. So the story continues. It's not over. It wasn't quick. It wasn't easy. And it certainly wasn't cost-free.
Hunger crises are precipitated by war's destruction of economies and the impoverishment of millions in the war zones. Poverty lessens people's abilities to grow and buy food, stay in their home communities, access clean water and sanitation, pay for healthcare and medicine, keep children away from hazardous jobs and other essential pathways to preserving health and life. explosive remnants of war, including unexploded mines, render land inaccessible to farm and block the transport of goods. Generally, populations displaced by violence face some of the worst levels of food insecurity and malnutrition.
Iran and Russia have signed an agreement on the construction of the Rasht-Astara Railway, a strategic transport corridor that connects the existing railways of the two countries and Azerbaijan. The Iranian Transport Minister and his Russian counterpart, Vitaly Savelyev, put their signatures on the deal worth $1.6 billion during a ceremony in Tehran on Wednesday. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his Russian counterpart oversaw the event in person and via video link. The 162-kilometer railway will connect the Iranian city of Rasht near the Caspian Sea to Astara on the border with Azerbaijan. Upon completion, the railway would serve as a shorter and cheaper transit pathway for Asia and Europe's businesses. The development would also turn Iran into the region's trade crossroads and bring along stable and profuse revenues for the Islamic Republic. Including the part that crosses Iran, the passage serves to link Europe to the Persian Gulf and the Indian Ocean's littoral states, as well as the southeastern Asian countries. Transporting goods through the pathway takes 21 days. The alternative maritime route that travels across Europe's western and then southern flank before heading into the Red Sea, however, takes 45 days to complete and features an additional 30% expense.
This is a very important agreement that allows us to move to a new stage in the development of cooperation in the transport field. This is the largest infrastructure project that concerns the construction of a 162-kilometer section of the railway between the Iranian city of Astara and the city of Rasht. This is the section that is enough to completely close the railway communication through the territory of Russia, Azerbaijan, Iran, from St. Petersburg to the Persian Gulf and to Bandar Abbas. As soon as this project is implemented, then accordingly we will have a route and the possibility of deliveries both in transit to Europe and deliveries from Russia to the Persian Gulf. This is a huge market.
Separately, Iran and Russia are expanding their cooperation in the banking sector. Russia's second largest bank, VTB, has opened a branch in Iran. VTB is the first ever Russian bank to offer services in the Islamic Republic. Last December, VTB launched a service allowing both individuals and businesses to transfer money to and from Iran. Iranian companies will now have the chance to make international bank transfers. Moreover, VTB Bank and its subsidiaries are extensively active in South American countries, empowering Iran to diversify its exchange routes with export target countries in that region. Earlier this year, Governor of the Central Bank of Iran, Mohammad Reza Farzin, said a direct link had been established between the central banks of Iran and Russia. Iran and Russia have signed scores of economic and energy deals as the two countries seek to replicate their successful security and military cooperation in efforts that could offset the impacts of Western sanctions on their economies. Russia's Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak led a high-ranking delegation to major events and ceremonies. Novak met Iranian Oil Minister Javad Oji and also visited a number of oil and gas equipment manufacturers and discussed prospects for working together in the fuel and energy sectors. He said the oil and gas industry is a backbone for the economies of our countries. Strengthening bilateral cooperation in this area will undoubtedly increase the economic sustainability of Russia and Iran.
We are developing 8 of our oil and gas fields with the strong Russian companies, and we have agreed with Mr. Novak for the development of 6 more fields.
The two sides also discussed cooperation in the field of electrical and nuclear energy, as well as renewable energy sources. Russia and Iran, both under Western sanctions, are forging closer ties in order to support their economies and to undermine Western sanctions, which they both cast as unjustified. Tehran and Moscow have embarked on deepening cooperation amid massive Western sanctions.
We are seeking specifically joint investments, facilitation of customs services and banking issues regarding the transfer of money between state banks and Mir Business Bank in Russia, which is of great help for Iranian businessmen.
Iran and Russia have signed major deals in recent months to boost economic, trade, energy and military cooperation. Russia is also delivering a complete squadron of Sukhoi Su-35 fighter jets to the Islamic Republic of Iran, development that will likely further rile up the West as Tehran and Moscow deepen their defense and economic cooperation in defiance of sweeping sanctions and coercive measures.
Turkey's presidential election is headed for a runoff vote. That's according to official results from the country's Supreme Election Council. President Recep Tayyip Erdogan took 49.5% of Sunday's vote, with his main challenger Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu getting 44.89%. More than 64 million Turkish people, including overseas voters, were eligible to vote, and nearly 89% participated in the election to choose their next president and parliament for a five-year term. As neither secured more than 50% of the vote, they will face off in a second round on May 28th. This is only the third time that Turks directly voted for a president, with Erdogan winning both previous elections outright in the first round. Polls and observers had predicted an advantage, if not an outright victory, for 74-year-old Kılıçdaroğlu. But as the final results from Sunday's election were announced, it became clear 69-year-old Erdogan had defied expectations, seizing a majority along with his nationalist coalition partners in parliament and forcing a second round vote in the presidential race. A voting observation mission by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe said political participation was high and voters had a choice between two political alternatives, but the incumbent president and the ruling parties enjoyed an unjustified advantage, including through biased media coverage. The polls were held against a background of a cost-of-living crisis that saw inflation peak at 85% in October, and earthquakes in February that killed more than 50,000 people in the country. These factors buoyed opposition hopes of unseating a leader known as Reis, or chief, by supporters of the governing Justice and Development Party. Kılıçdaroğlu has promised to fix Turkey's faltering economy and restore democratic institutions compromised under Erdogan's rule. Erdogan, on the other hand, has been extolling the virtues of his long rule, campaigning on a platform of a stability, independent foreign policy, and continuing to bolster Turkey's defense industry. Recently, he raised the wage of government workers by 45% and lowered the retirement age. Taking place at the same time as the presidential race was the election of 600 parliamentary deputies. Although this was mostly lost amid the debate about Erdogan and Kılıçdaroğlu and whether either would gather more than 50% of the vote and thus avoid a second round. Turkey's election is widely considered to be the most important in the world this year, as a fight for the future of Turkish democracy and a possible shift in Turkey's influential role on the world stage. Parliamentary and presidential elections took place in Turkey on Sunday. In the 600-seat parliament, Erdogan's Justice and Development Party and its allies secured by far the most seats, 321, while the opposition won 213, and the 66 remaining seats went to a pro-Kurdish alliance. The elections are crucial to the future of Turkey's battered economy. Also, the vote had been presented as a last chance to stop Erdogan from turning the country into a full-blown autocracy. From 2003, Erdogan served three terms as prime minister. In 2014, when he was barred from running again, Erdogan stood for the largely ceremonial role of president. In 2016, he survived a coup, but that only strengthened his grip and consolidated his political standing in the country. A year later, he won a referendum that gave him sweeping presidential powers. While Erdogan's grip on the levers of power has brought Turkey close to autocracy, he has made serious economic missteps recently. He has increased his control of the theoretically independent central bank and steadfastly refused to increase interest rates despite soaring inflation. Turkish people are far poorer and more uncertain of their future as a result. The government response to the devastating recent earthquake was widely viewed as inadequate. In February, Erdogan made the tone-deaf comment that whatever happens, happens. This is part of fate's plan. However, he has outperformed expectations and appears to be further ahead than was previously predicted. Kılıçdaroğlu, a former accountant and bureaucrat and the longtime head of the Republican People's Party, was not a universally popular choice among the opposition to a stand. A social democrat, Kılıçdaroğlu, is at the head of a coalition that includes nationalists who are only supporting him because of their desperation to unseat Erdogan. He has promised to stand down after a single term after instituting more conventional economic policies and restoring full parliamentary democracy. CHP leader Kılıçdaroğlu's six-party nation alliance has pledged to dismantle an executive presidential system narrowly voted in by a 2017 referendum. The opposition alliance also promised to restore the independence of the judiciary and the central bank and to reverse crackdowns on free speech and dissent under Erdogan. Turkey's elections had been billed as the most consequential since its first fair multi-party polls in 1950, boiling down to a choice between five more years of Erdogan, Turkey's most electorally successful politician, or a new direction under an old party that has reinvented itself in recent years.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
The lead author of a new analysis shows that poverty in the U.S. silently killed 10 times as many people as all the homicides in 2019. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout wrote in this regard, a research published recently in the Journal of the American Medical Association estimated that poverty was linked to at least 183,000 deaths in the United States in 2019 among people aged 15 or older, making inadequate income the nation's fourth leading mortality driver that year behind heart disease, cancer, and smoking. Poverty kills as much as dementia, accidents, stroke, Alzheimer's, and diabetes, said David Brady, a professor of public policy at the University of California, Riverside, and the lead author of the new analysis. Brady continued, "Poverty silently killed 10 times as many people as all the homicides in 2019, and yet homicide, firearms, and suicide get vastly more attention." Dr. William J. Barber, co-chair of the Poor People's Campaign, wrote recently that the research underlines the importance of connecting extremist inaction on gun violence to other forms of policy murder. The new analysis, co-authored by Ulrich Kohler of the University of Potsdam in Germany and Hoi Zheng of Ohio State University, stressed that the U.S. perennially has a far higher poverty rate than peer-rich democracies, which presents an enormous challenge to population health, given that considerable research demonstrates that being in poverty is bad for one's health. poverty, which the study defined as less than half the median U.S. income, was associated with greater mortality than many far more visible causes in 2019, 10 times as many deaths as homicide, 4.7 times as many deaths as firearms, 3.9 times as many deaths as suicide, and 2.6 times as many deaths as drug overdose. The researchers argue their results indicate poverty should be considered a major risk factor for deaths in the U.S., which has seen life expectancy decline since 2015 and fall sharply amid the coronavirus pandemic. The researchers wrote, because the U.S. consistently has high poverty rates, these estimates can contribute to understanding why the U.S. has comparatively lower life expectancy, because certain ethnic and racial minority groups are far more likely to be in poverty. Our estimates can improve understanding of ethnic and racial inequalities in life expectancy. They continued, the mortality associated with poverty is also associated with enormous economic costs. Therefore, benefit-cost calculations of poverty-reducing social policies should incorporate the benefits of lower mortality. Moreover, poverty likely aggravated the mortality impact of COVID-19, which occurred after our analysis ended in 2019. Therefore, one limitation of this study is that our estimates may be conservative about the number of deaths associated with poverty. The onset of the coronavirus pandemic in 2020 brought about a sharp increase in U.S. poverty as millions of people got sick, were thrown out of work, and lost health insurance. But federal aid initiatives enacted in response to the public health and economic crisis, from stimulus checks to boosted unemployment benefits to enhanced nutrition assistance, ultimately led to a significant drop in poverty, further bolstering the case that poverty is a policy choice. However, many of those poverty-reducing aid programs, including the enhanced child tax credit that sharply slashed poverty among kids in the U.S., have since lapsed or been terminated, threatening to reverse any recent progress. Brady said in a statement that if the U.S. had less poverty, there would be a lot better health and well-being. People could work more and they could be more productive. He added, of all of these, there are benefits of investing in people through social policies. Also, according to the U.S. News, poverty is the fourth greatest cause of death in the United States, according to a new research. Researchers at the University of California, Riverside, estimate that poverty was associated with 183,000 deaths in 2019 among people 15 years old and older. And that's a conservative estimate, they say, because the year was just prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. People living in poverty have incomes less than 50% of the U.S. median income. The researchers noted, in 2021, the median household income was $70,784 per household, according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Impoverished Americans have roughly the same survival rates as richer folks until they hit their 40s. Then they die at significantly higher rates, according to the study. The analysis found that only heart disease, cancer, and smoking kill more people than poverty. Deaths related to obesity, diabetes, drug overdoses, suicides, firearms, and homicides were all fewer than deaths associated with poverty.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود غده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniya on April 18th, 2023.
Today's student is someone who will be active in the fields of culture and the media tomorrow. Today's student is tomorrow's leader, mastermind, and an influential element. People don't stay young and aren't students forever. Today, you can prepare the ground in such a way that when tomorrow comes and you become one of the elements that I mentioned, you will be able to have an impact in the true sense of the world. You can change both the thinking and the reality of your society. Today, everyone is saying this. I have said it, and others are saying it too. The world is undergoing a transformation. Who's creating this transformation? Masterminds, people who are active in different fields, and those who are involved in big projects are the ones who are creating this transformation. You are among them. You are students today.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today. And that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Tomorrow you will be the ones who can bring about changes. Thus, I expect you to look to the future in this manner. Of course, the person who can make a change tomorrow is not necessarily a pious, outstanding, faithful believer. Sometimes some people deviate. You should try to avoid deviation. You need to try and move on the straight path of God. You are moving toward that kind of a tomorrow. Strengthen your foundations, your intellectual foundation, your foundation in faith, your foundation in being rational. From today, so that you can be ready for that kind of tomorrow. It seems to me that there are four points here: religion, wisdom, science, and determination. These four things are necessary. Religious foundations, scientific foundations, intellectual foundations, and foundations in determination, unwavering determination, unwavering resoluteness. You need to strengthen these in yourselves. Whoever is able to work on self-improvement more in these areas will be more influential in the future. Some will reach the peak. Some may not reach the top, but they will make an impact to some degree. It all depends on how much you have prepared yourselves. This is another point.
Allah, I want to thank you. That you've done. you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Nakba didn't end in 1948. It continues to impact Palestinians daily. Nakba Day serves as a reminder that until there is an end to the Zionist regime's occupation, there can be no hope for peace. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Throughout writing this regard, commenting on the recent elections, Israeli journalist Gideon Levy wrote in Haaretz that the aftermath of the elections have shown that Israeli society has become partly religious and largely racist, with hatred of Arabs being its main fuel, with no one to stand against it. While the Zionist regime continues invading Palestinian cities and killing Palestinians daily, in the United States, there is no outcry or condemnation from the Biden administration whatsoever. On the contrary, the U.S. rewards the Zionist regime with $3.8 billion in taxpayer dollars annually and demands zero accountability for its behavior in return. Congress's overwhelming silence and fear of criticizing the Israeli regime makes it complicit in the ongoing suffering of Palestinians. The U.S. has become the top enabler of Israel's systematic segregation and discrimination against the population on the basis of race. It was hardly surprising to learn that as the Zionist regime rained missiles on Gaza during Operation Shield and Arrow, Secretary of State of the United States Antony Blinken, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin, and National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan rushed to proclaim their support for the Zionist regime's, as they claim, right to defend itself. Last month, U.S. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis all visited the occupied territories of Palestine to pledge allegiance to the Zionist regime. Before them, Blinken visited the occupied territories of Palestine and reaffirmed the U.S. ironclad support for the Zionist regime, which recently voted in the most fascist, extremist, far-right government in its history. In his speech, Blinken referred to the U.S. special relationship with the Zionist regime that is rooted in shared values. Similarly, during his last visit to the occupied territories of Palestine, President Joe Biden was eager to show unshakable support for the architects of this inhumane and cruel policy of apartheid and denial of Palestinian rights. All of these actions enable the Zionist regime's crimes to go on without any recourse, punishment, or accountability. International human rights organizations, including Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch, have issued extensive reports that included that the Zionist regime practices apartheid. United Nations Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Occupied Palestinian Territory, Francesca Albanese, has come under vicious attacks following her report highlighting the Zionist regime, settler colonialism, and apartheid. Palestinians continue to be colonized. Palestinian lands continue to be confiscated for illegal settlement building. Palestinian family members continue to be separated from one another by walls. Palestinian communities continue to be forcibly displaced. Palestinian homes continue to be demolished. Palestinian farmers' olive trees continue to be uprooted. Palestinian children continue to be terrorized and killed by IDF. Palestinian refugees continue to be exiled. And Palestinians living inside the occupied territories continue to be discriminated against. With the complicity of its greatest ally, the U.S. regime, Israel has not only continued but has intensified its inhumane policies and violations of international law. It's hard for Palestinians to not feel helpless when they are subjected to these massive injustices for so long. But they have shown tremendous resilience and are inspired by the collective support of people in the global community and the many gains achieved by the growing boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The magnitude of global solidarity with Palestinians shows that people, especially the younger generation, are no longer looking away. While fear and intimidation tactics by Israeli lobby groups have worked with elected officials, they have failed to gain support on the public level, especially among young Jews. Today, Palestinians have more support from people around the world than ever before, as we have seen exhibited during the FIFA World Cup and the scenes of the ever-present Palestinian flag held by supporters throughout the tournament. But while the public discourse is changing, the opposite is taking place in the Republican-controlled U.S. Congress. Recently, U.S. House Speaker McCarthy blocked Representative Rashida Tlaib from hosting an event at the Capitol commemorating the Nakba. Despite McCarthy's attempts, the event went ahead anyway, moved to a Senate office room thanks to Senator Bernie Sanders, who was able to secure a new venue in the Dirksen Senate Office Building, where McCarthy has no justification. The Nakba Day did not end in 1948. It continues to impact Palestinians everywhere daily. A Nakba Day 75 serves as an important reminder that until there is an end to the occupation, until Palestinians get justice, freedom, and equal rights, and until the Zionist regime adheres to international law, there can be no hope for peace. Oh. Also, according to Crescent International, civil rights movements dedicated to justice for Palestine have increased the tempo to isolate the Zionist regime. Support from trade unions, media commentators, political pundits, academics, and a few courageous political parties in parliament is evidence of the deep felt outrage against apartheid Israel. When and what is required to end Zionist settler colonialism are key questions as commemoration events mark 75 years of ethnic cleansing, occupation, and incremental genocide, and Nakba. Given that the heart of Palestinian resistance is located in and around Masjid al-Aqsa in occupied Al-Quds, revered by the global Muslim community as Islam's sacred citadel, liberation of Palestine remains connected to its inviolability. Armed struggle within the belly of the beast in the occupied West Bank has emerged as a focal point of resistance that not only has galvanized armed resistance in the rest of 1948 Palestine, but also inspired millions across the world. The storming of Al-Aqsa and ruthless violence against women, children, and the elderly engaged in worship during Ramadan by heavily armed Zionist troops, met with a barrage of rockets fired not only from Gaza, but also from South Lebanon, Syria, to the shock and awe of the fabricated regime of Israel.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
UNICEF representative for Afghanistan says some 90% of the population in the country is on the brink of poverty, while children are the ones who are bearing the brunt of it. The UNICEF states some 2.3 million children in Afghanistan are expected to face malnutrition in the country, while roughly 1.6 million Afghan children, some as young as 6, are trapped in child labor, working in dangerous conditions just to help their parents put food on the table.
The children pick these waste materials and sell it to me. Instead of going to school, they work to earn a bread worth. These kids are doing this job out of necessity because some of them have sick parents and take care of them, or their parents have no job and tell the children to do this for a living. They can hardly buy bread with this earning.
Mohammad Qasem, a 12-year-old worker, says he can't go to school because he should provide bread for the family.
I am 12 years old. I pick these bottles under the scorching sun to sell and buy bread for the family with this money. I don't go to school because I work every day to earn some money. It has been 3 years that I have been doing this.
Experts believe decades of war and unrest in the country is to blame for the poverty, which is compelling families to send their loved ones on the streets to find a mouthful. But of course, the negative consequences aren't negligible.
Most of the problems in the society originate from poverty. It is due to this poverty that our children are working on the streets. But we should keep in mind that the child who is working on the street is a lost valuable asset without a bright future for the country.
U.S.-led war in Afghanistan has ruined the country's economy. It has also made Afghanistan weapons contaminated too. 134 children were killed or maimed while collecting scrap metal to sell from explosive devices between January and March of this year alone. While Afghanistan is struggling to resolve problems left behind from decades of war, many people here believe U.S. sanctions and the reduction of activities of international organizations have made the situation more complicated in the country. Abdullah Amirzadeh, Kabul.
The Islamic Jihad Resistance Movement has organized a celebration event in Damascus countryside, marking its victory against Israel in the recent battle in the Gaza Strip. In a televised speech, Secretary General of the movement, Ziad Nakhale, announced the victory against the Israeli regime, expressing pride in the people of Gaza, who he said manufactured their own weapons with the help of member countries of the resistance front.
We succeeded in the battle and we preserved Palestinians' unity. We proved to the enemy our continuous readiness to engage in battle after another in defense of our people. Any assassination operation will be met with a strong, clear and painful response in which Tel Aviv or other Israeli cities will